In December of 1862, the Civil War is raging, and a General Burnside was the commander of the Army of the Potomac, that is the Union Army, and he suffered a crushing defeat at the hands of General Robert E. Lee, who, of course, headed up the Confederate forces. Well, in response to this defeat, which was just a disaster, President Lincoln, in January of 1863, appointed a new general. This was General Joe Hooker. He was to replace General Burnside, and he would be the commander now of the Union forces. And what General Hooker was able to do with this gloomy, dispirited army that had suffered such a terrible defeat, in the words of another general, General Darvis Crouch, said what he did with that army was just magical, how he transformed it, because they were dispirited. They had just suffered a horrible defeat. Well, General Hooker spent the early months of 1863 rebuilding this army. He organized it, he consolidated it, and he inspired his troops, and everything was looking quite well. Hooker was in command of a fighting force of some 130,000 men. This included 17,000 horsemen, and this is a massive army, 17,000 horsemen, tens of thousands of infantrymen, and huge, great concourses of artillery pieces. General Hooker brimmed over with confidence. He stated, "I have the finest army on the planet." And winter, he took over in January. Winter turned to spring. And on the morning of April 29th, General Lee, the general of the opposing forces, and his army of a mere 60,000 men awoke to the sound of distant gunfire. It looked like a large engagement would begin. What would become known as the Battle of Chancellorsville was about to begin at this point in time. General Hooker aimed to crush Lee and his Confederate army, because he had spent months building this army. It was disciplined, and it was ready. Never before had the Union army been so well positioned. Never had it been so well up in strength and style. Never had it been better situated to destroy the Confederate army with General Lee. When daylight of May 1st arrived, the forward units prepared to move against General Lee. But no orders came. No orders, the orders that they anticipated would come from General Hooker, never came. And the morning wore on, and still no orders came. Then Lee, the general of the opposing of the Confederates, ordered his vastly outnumbered troops to attack Hooker's front. So you have this massive army that's been anticipating this, and the orders never came to move forward. To the Union army, when Lee's comparatively small force moved against it, it seemed to them to be not much more than a skirmish, a really minor battle. After all, behind the Union army was this overwhelming resources of men and equipment. The thinking was, once they brushed aside this rebel threat, they could surge forward and take Fredericksburg, take Richmond, and that would be the end of the war, which everybody wanted. Then there arrived what seemed to everybody there and all the generals associated with it, there arrived an absolutely incomprehensible moment that was not understood at that point in time, and neither to this very day is it completely understood. Messengers came from General Hooker. They bore orders, but the orders were unthinkable. The orders were simply impossible to believe. The orders were pull back, withdraw, retreat. All of his effort, everything they did to be ready for this, and the orders were no pull back. One general refused to believe it. He said, "Nobody but a crazy man would give such an order when we have victory in sight." Well, retreat they did. And the army, the Union army, headed by General Hooker, lost Chancellorsville. We don't remember General Hooker for a victory at Chancellorsville. Actually, just as a sidebar here, General Hooker is remembered by the name Hooker, which is associated with the camp girls that followed the Union Army. That is actually where that term originated from. It was the ladies of the night that followed the Union forces, and they became known as Hooker's girls, and that term has stuck with it ever since. But anyway, Hooker had froze. He had put all this time and all this effort into this, and he froze. He seemed in a crumpled trance, helpless, lethargic, entirely demoralized. General Hooker held every advantage, but he never utilized the resources that were available to him. as we look at what happened to General Hooker there, and that he didn't utilize the advantages and resources available, we have to ask ourselves, does that sound like somebody you know? Does it sound like somebody you know? Does it sound like you? Does it sound like me? Do I fail to take advantage of, to utilize the resources that are available to myself, the resources that are available to you? And of course, I mean that mostly in a spiritual context. The resources that are available to you, the resources that are available to me, is the very Spirit of God, the very Spirit of God. In Galatians 1 and verse 6, we turn there for a moment. The people of God as people in this world oftentimes lose their grip. They become froze like General Hooker did, and they lose every advantage that has been given to them. You know, we are an advantaged people. Sometimes people might think they live a disadvantaged life. If you have the truth of God, you have an advantaged life no matter what your situation might be. But Galatians 1 and verse 6, Paul in his letter said, I marvel, speaking to the brethren, he said, I marvel that you were turning away so soon from him who called you in the grace of Christ to a different gospel. People who had been prepared, had been taught and instructed, and were turning loose of what they had. They too either allowed it to slowly slip through their hand, or they froze for whatever the reasons may be in their own particular situations. Let's go to the Old Testament, 2 Kings. Go to the Old Testament, 2 Kings, and chapter 6. 2 Kings, chapter 6. And it looks like we'll pick it up about verse 13. Israel was in conflict with Syria, and the moves that the Syrian army were going to conduct, God was revealing that to his prophet at that time, Elisha, and Elisha was getting word to the army of Israel, and the Syrian king thought there was a spy in his camp, wanted to know what was going on. So let's pick it up in verse 11 of 2 Kings 6. Therefore, the heart of the king of Syria was greatly troubled by this thing, because he was realizing that every move he was going to make was known. So his heart was greatly troubled, and he called his servants and said to them, will you not show me which of us is for the king of Israel? And one of the servants said, none, my lord, O king, but Elisha the prophet, who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. In other words, this prophet of God, God gives him understanding, and he conveys the word to Israel. So he said, go and see where he is, that I may send and get him. And it was told him, saying, surely he is in Dothan. Therefore, he sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night and surrounded the city. And when the servant of the man of God arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. So this is a servant of Elisha, who is the prophet. The king of Syria has sent horsemen to go and get this prophet, and Elisha's servant wakes up early, is looking outside, and all around him he sees these Syrian troops surrounding him. In verse 15, when the servant of the man of God arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, alas, my master, what shall we do? He was greatly concerned. So he answered, this is Elisha answering his servant, do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Elisha had a confidence too. He was prepared just as General Hooker was prepared, but General Hooker froze and didn't move. But Elisha was cut from a different cloth. And Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of the horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. So they weren't by themselves at all. They were not outnumbered by this Syrian army. God opened the servant's eyes, and he was able to see. So as we go through this, as Elisha asked God there, open his eyes that he may see, I would say, brethren, as we go through the Word of God today or any day that we go through the Word of God, may God open our eyes, because God is not a respecter of persons. Elisha, Elijah, any of the greats of old, we're not in some special category. They're special to God, yes, but they were human beings who yielded to God. And that same thing is available to the people of God nowadays, who will yield to God and be led by him. So we want God to open our eyes to see beyond what sometimes seems to be the obvious in front of us. Because you too, brethren, and I, each one of us, at different times and in different circumstances, you're going to face your Chancellorville, just as General Hooker did. And God, the whole time, just as General Hooker spent the winter and the spring preparing his troops, drilling them and marching them and teaching them how to use the weapons that were theirs, God has done the same thing for you and I every day of our life through different circumstances. He is preparing us for things that lie ahead that we are unable to see at this time, and probably in many cases, good that we don't see them until the time comes. But God is preparing you, God is preparing me for whatever trials it may be that we face, because it is a surety, brethren, that there will be dark days, there will be dark chapters in our lives. So we want to make sure that we do not freeze up as General Hooker did. We want to learn to trust in God's provision. Provision had been made for General Hooker. President Lincoln saw to it that he had whatever supplies he needed. They were there. And we want, brethren, to learn to trust in God's provision. That's basically what I'll think we'll title the sermon today. Trust in God's provision. God will provide. God will provide the things that we need. After that debacle at Chancellorville, General Hooker, in a conversation he had with a General Abner Doubleday, Doubleday said, "I was not hurt by a shell." He's just confiding in him what took place. He says, "I was not hurt by a shell, and I was not drunk," which was not uncommon sometimes for the soldiers back then. "I was not hurt by a shell, and I was not drunk. For once I lost confidence in Hooker, and that is all there was to it." He lost heart. He froze. He lost confidence in Hooker. And brethren, we cannot lose that confidence, not in ourselves, but the confidence in God and in his provision, and that God has worked with you and prepared you just as that army was prepared and sat there and did nothing. And the smaller army of the Confederacy tore it to pieces. Our confidence must be in God. God has made it clear that he is with those who trust him. He is with us, and he is with us with absolutely unlimited resources. Remember, God's resources are not limited. Let's go in 2 Chronicles chapter 16, 2 Chronicles 16. Another one of those scriptures that, you know, we can read and maybe not focus on it the way we should. 2 Chronicles chapter 16 and verse 2 and 3. There was a war going on. Well, actually, verse 1. "In the 36th year of the reign of Asa, Baasha, the king of Israel, came up against Judah and built Ramah." They built a kind of a fortress off away from there because he was trying to seal off that city and take it, that he might let none go out or come in to Asa, who was the king of Judah. So you have Israel and Judah at war with one another. "Then Asa brought silver and gold from the treasuries of the house of the Lord and of the king's house, and he sent it to Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, who dwelt in Damascus, saying, 'Let there be a treaty between you and me, as there was between my father and your father. Here I have sent you silver and gold. Come and break your treaty with the king of Israel, so that he will withdraw from me.'" So he's under attack. Judah's under attack. The king of Judah takes a bribe, takes wealth from the kingdom, sends it to Syria, asking him to come in and save Judah. So Ben-Hadad, in verse 4, he heeded King Asa and sent his captains to the armies, and the army of Israel did withdraw. But let's drop down in verse 7. "And at that time, Hananiah, the seer, came to Asa, the king of Judah." Asa is the one who made the contract with Syria, basically bought their protection, bought their help. Well, God is sending a man now to the king to talk to him. "He came to Asa, the king of Judah, and said, 'Because you have relied on the king of Syria and not relied on the Lord your God, therefore the army of the king of Syria has escaped from your hand.'" What God is saying, if you would have relied upon me, I would have handed them over to you, lock, stock, and barrel. But no, you had to rely to buy your protection. Were the Ethiopians, he's taking him back down memory lane, because God had been with him before. Were the Ethiopians, in verse 8 and 11, not a huge army with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he delivered them into your hand. When you trusted me, I delivered them into your hand. And then verse 9, which is the takeaway here we want, for the eyes of the Lord, the eyes of the Eternal, run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him. So it literally tells us that God searches this earth, north to south, east to west, corner to corner, searching for people whose heart is dedicated to him. And he's looking for opportunities to show himself strong on their behalf. That is a resource, brethren, that you have. He offers that to us. It is provision that God has made for us. God is not a respecter of persons. He is the same, as we know from scriptures. God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. What he did 2,000 years ago, he will do today. What he did 4,000 years ago, he will do today. What God did for those who leaned on him in the past, he will do for those who trust him today. So what is it? Often that can be any number of things, I'm sure. Probably a very long list if we took our time and really went through it. But what is it that can keep you from exercising the advantages that you have? In part, sometimes it is we think we don't have an advantage. You know, we get into a woe is me set of mind, and it all goes downhill from there. But just three things I jotted down real quick, and certainly it's not an all-encompassing list at all, but just three things that jotted to my mind that would keep us from exercising the advantages that we have. First, fear. Fear. Materialism. Materialism. Because we live, obviously, no lesson needed here, we live in a terribly materialistic society and culture. And materialism drowns people. It drowns people. Materialism is one of those things which, if your mindset is that way, it will eat you up. You will drown in materialism. So fear can stop us, materialism, and just plain old-fashioned laziness. Those three things came to my mind will prevent people from exercising the advantages that God has given to us. Laziness, just, you know, not willing to exert yourself, and which is what is required in the physical life that we have and also in the spiritual life. Well, let's look at some individuals who we can look at their lives, and we'll see that God made provision for them. He made material provisions for them. And he bolstered them. When they need to be bolstered up, he bolstered them up. Let's go to Judges chapter 6 and look at Gideon. Judges 6. And look at him for a little bit here. Judges chapter 6. And Israel is oppressed at this point in time by the Midianites. Now, remember, the book of Judges is Israel being oppressed for 20, 30, 40 years. They cry out. God sends a deliverer. He delivers them. They get the whoever the opposing force is expelled from the country. Israel goes right back in a period of time, goes right back into their sin, and they find themselves oppressed again. In chapter 6 of Judges, we find they are oppressed by the Midianites. Now, the Midianites, remember, Midian was one of the sons of Abraham and Keturah, his second wife. So family tie here, but they are the one, and they were a thorn in Israel's side day in and day out. Well, they were oppressing Israel. If they were growing a crop, or when they grew their crops, they had to hide the crop because they lived by plunder. The Midianites lived by plunder. They'd come in, let you produce the crop. They'd haul it off, take your animals off and everything else. So we find Gideon here in verse 16, I believe is where we'll pick it up. Anyway, Gideon is inside of a wine press preparing the grain. And the Lord said to him, he's going to begin to deal with Gideon now. And the Lord said to him, surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man. Then he said to him, if now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who talk with me. So God has said to Gideon, I'm going to use you. I'm going to deliver Israel. Because, again, he's hiding in a wine press to prepare the grain and stuff that he grew. Because if the Midianites see him out there, they will just come and take it. And so God said, I'm going to use you. Gideon is going to ask him now, how do I know that it's you that talk with me? Do not depart from me, verse 18, and do not depart from me here, I pray, until I come to you and bring out my offering and set it before you. And he said, I will wait until you come back. This is the angel of the Lord. Then Gideon went in and prepared a young goat and unleavened bread and an ephah of flour. The meat he put in a basket, and he put the broth in a pot, and he brought them out to him underneath the tree, and he presented it to him. And the angel of God said to him, take the meat and the unleavened bread that you have lay them on this rock and pour out the broth. And he did so. Then the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand, and he touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and fire rose out of the rock. He just caused fire to come up out of the rock and consume that offering. Gideon needed some encouragement. Gideon needed some encouragement. Fire rose up out of the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread, and the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight. Now Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Lord, so Gideon said, "Alas, O Lord God, for I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." Then the Lord said to him, "Peace be with you. Do not fear. You shall not die." Again, all of those words are God making provision for somebody. God is encouraging him, saying, "Don't fear. I'm with you. You shall not die." So Gideon built an altar there to the Lord, and he called it Lord Shalom, and to this day it is still there. And it came to pass that same night that the Lord said to him, "Take your father's young bull, the second bull of seven, and tear down an altar." So God told him, go and tear down this altar, this pagan altar that was in the town. Gideon did that. He followed through, and he did that. Then, verse 36, let's go to verse 36. Then Gideon said to God, "If you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, look, let's do this. I shall put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only, and it is dry on the ground, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said." So he's saying, I'm going to lay this fleece out on the floor here, and if in the morning, if it's covered with dew and the ground is dry, then I'll take that as a sign, because dew would fall on everything equally, right? And it was so when he rose early the next morning and squeezed the fleece together, he wrung out dew from the fleece, a bowl full of water. Still, though, Gideon needs to be encouraged more. He's still not up to the task. Then Gideon said to God, "Don't be angry with me and let me speak just once more. Just once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece, but on all the ground let there be dew." And God did so that night. It was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew all over the ground. So just the opposite of what had happened the night before. And God is providing for Gideon. He had a job for him. He's providing for him just as General Hooker was provided for, all the resources he needed. God does that with his people as well. Judges chapter 7, Gideon's confidence is up somewhat now, and God is going to use him to free Israel. Then Gideon and all the people who were with him rose early, chapter 7, and encamped beside the well of Herod, so that the camp of the Midianites was on the north side of them by the hill of Moreth in the valley. And the Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into your hand, lest Israel claim victory for itself against me." Gideon had an army, I believe, of 32,000 men. And, you know, like General Hooker, of course, the more troops he had, the better he felt. God said, that's not the case here. You've got way too many soldiers. "Now, therefore, proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn apart at once from Mount Gilead." And 22,000 of the people returned and 10,000 remained. So gave him an open door, said, if you're really not up to the task here, you're frightened by this, go ahead and take off. Two-thirds of the army departed. And the Lord said to Gideon, "Well, the people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. And it will be that of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, the same shall go with you. And whomever I say to you, this one shall not go, the same shall not go." So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, "Everyone who laps the water with his tongue, as a dog laps, you shall set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink." And the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men, and all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink. So all of those that got down on their knees to drink, God told Gideon, we don't want those. Those who took their hands, scooped the water up, and then brought it to their face and drank, God said, we'll keep them. Apparently, some of the commentaries will vary on that, but it would indicate that these people who scooped the water up, they were more watchful. You know, if you get down on your knees, put your face down in the water like a deer or elk or something like that, you know, you don't know what's coming behind you. And remember, the Midianites were camped close by. So these, it just showed they were more alert, probably going to be a more reliable soldier. So God sifted them out a little bit farther. But all the while, God is preparing. So he reduced them down He reduced Gideon's troops down from 32,000 to 300 men. That's a force reduction of, I think, 99%. So he brought them down. God was going to give them the victory, but he didn't want them thinking it was because of their numbers and their expertise that the victory was theirs, that God was the one that delivered. So God knows that Gideon still needs more confidence, and God's going to make more provision for Gideon yet. He's going to bring all these things, just orchestrate and bring this whole thing where Gideon can have the confidence that he needs. So in chapter 7 and verse 9, "So it happened on the same night that the Lord said to him," that is to Gideon, "arise now, I want you to go down against the camp, for I have delivered it into your hand." So he's saying, okay, this is the night, we're going to take them tonight. "And if you are afraid to go down to the camp, go with Purah, your servant, and you shall hear what they say, and afterward your hands will be strengthened to go down against the camp. Then he went down with Purah, his servant, to the outpost of the armed men who were at the camp." So Gideon and his servant are sneaking down on this stealth operation down around the camp of the Midianites, and God is orchestrating them to a particular camp to where he has given a particular dream to a soldier in the opposing camp and has somebody there to interpret that dream to the soldier who had the dream in the hearing of Gideon. Okay? So that's basically where we're at here. Okay, verse 13. "And when Gideon had come there, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. He said, 'I have just had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian, and it came to a tent and struck it so that it fell and overturned, and the tent collapsed.'" So all these things are coming together. Gideon and his companion are coming to the Midian camp. God has put a dream in one of the Midianite soldiers' head, given him that dream, and has the other individual there to interpret it, and has Gideon and his companion there to hear. "Then his companion answered and said, 'This is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, the man of Israel, for into his hand God has delivered Midianites and the whole camp.' So it was when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation that he worshipped." So right there, it would indicate that right there in the brush or wherever he was, Gideon was overwhelmed with the gratitude and the knowledge that surely God has brought this about. All this juncture of things coming together perfectly. He worshiped there, and he goes back, and he gets his soldiers together. We know the story, brethren. They had the 300 men were equipped with a trumpet. Each one had a trumpet, and they had some kind of earthen pitcher. And then they had fire inside that pitcher, like a torch that they put inside their earthen pitcher so that the light didn't show up. They split up into three different groups, and they went down, and that at Gideon's command, there was a blast of the trumpet, and then they broke the pitchers, exposing the light, and they all yelled. And then this happened. Verse 19, "So Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to the outpost of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just as they had posted the watch." This would be about 10 p.m., 10:30. So you have men coming off of watch. They're tired. They want to get to the camp and get some sleep. You have those who are coming out to go on watch who maybe just woke up out of a sleep. And at that moment is when God has the forces of Gideon come in. So they blow the trumpets. They break the pitcher, expose all this light all of a sudden. And they yell. And the Midianites think they're surrounded by, who knows, tens of thousands of troops. They all turn on each other. And the Midianites kill themselves. They kill themselves. The victory was given to Gideon and his forces by God. But again, the takeaway what we want here, brethren, is God made the provision. God made the provision. God was working even in the enemy's camp, if you'll notice that. When Gideon was concerned, God was working in the enemy camp. He was putting a dream in the mind of that soldier. And he caused him to have that particular dream, had the other guy interpret it. And all of that is God working. God always makes provision. And let's go back in chapter 6 in Judges. This is when the angel of the Lord first came to Gideon. "And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, 'The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor.'" Now, if we go back and rehearse everything that God did to bring Gideon to this point, was Gideon really a mighty man of valor at that point in time? God might have saw that the potential that he could be, but God made him into a mighty man of valor. by all of the encouragement and stuff that he continued to give him. He says, okay, put the fleece out. I'll put dew on the fleece. Okay, the next night there'll be no dew on the fleece. The dew will be on the ground. Okay, I'll let you hear a dream. All these things that God did in order to encourage him and to keep him going. We could look at the story of David and Goliath and 1 Samuel. The Philistines stood on one side and Israel on the other. David's father had told him to take supplies to his brothers who were part of Saul's army. And while he's there, David hears the taunts of Goliath. He hears Goliath taunting the army of Israel. David's consideration at that time was not the size of his foe. He's looking at this massive human being across the valley yelling these insults at Israel and its God. David, his consideration was not the size of the opposing force at all. Let's go there, 1 Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 17, 1 Samuel 17, verse 37, I think we can pick it up. David is somewhat dumbfounded by the fact that this big guy across the way, the Philistine, is yelling all these insults and nothing's taking place. And so he is making himself available. In verse 36, your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them. How does David have such confidence? The latter part of that verse, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. Moreover, David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine. And Saul said to David, go and the Lord be with you. So David had resources. How did David gather those resources? By living each day of his life until that point of time, tending to his father's flocks, and the confidence that was developed in him, that God saw to was developed in him, that God delivered the lion and the bear to him. And David viewed this Goliath as just something that God would take care of. It wasn't a matter of how large he was or how taunting he was. David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And we know what he did. He went out there and with his sling, tossed a stone, hit Goliath apparently right between the eyes, or a temple, I can't remember where it was. He went down, he's knocked out, he's unconscious. David takes his sword and cuts off his head right there on the spot. David's confidence was in his God and the resources that God had. This confidence, this faith that he had, came from his experience, as I mentioned earlier. Now, experience, brethren, is what we get when we get engaged in life. Experience is what we get when we get off of our backside and walk out the door and engage in whatever aspect of life is before us. That's called experience. And it can be the simplest thing. David's experience that prepared him to be a king was following after sheep and goats and being obedient to his father. And 1 Samuel 17:45, when he goes out to meet Goliath, and David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin. David had none of that. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. So David's confidence was in God. And just as a side note here, in 2 Samuel, let's go to 2 Samuel. When David was fleeing from his son Absalom, Absalom had orchestrated a rebellion, was trying to take over the kingdom, and David was fleeing, and he comes in chapter 17 of 2 Samuel, verse 28. He's fleeing, and he is met there by a guy named, some other people as well, but Barzillai meets him there, and he brought beds and basins, earthen vessels, because David is fleeing. David and his people are fleeing, and this Barzillai brought beds and basins, earthen vessels and wheat, barley and flour, parched grain and beans, lentils and parched seeds, honey and curds and sheep and cheese of the herd for David and the people who were with him to eat. For they said, these people are hungry, weary, and thirsty in the wilderness. So this man comes and provides. And there's a lesson, because remember, David was a man after God's own heart. David never forgot this man. If you go to 2 Samuel 19:31, after Absalom was defeated, and David is now going to be back at the throne at Jerusalem. So he's coming back, and verse 31 of 2 Samuel 19, verse 31, And Barzillai the Gileadite came down and went across the Jordan with the king to escort him across the Jordan. David is going back now to the capital. And Barzillai was a very aged man, 80 years old, and he had provided the king with supplies. We just read about that earlier, while he stayed at Mahanaim, for he was a very rich man. And the king said to Barzillai, come across with me, and I will provide for you while you are with me in Jerusalem. David remembered his kindness. David remembered the kindness of Barzillai. But Barzillai said to the king, how long have I to live? And he goes on and says, look, my days are limited. I'm just fine. But he says, I am today 80 years old. Can I discern between good and bad? Can your servant taste and eat what I drink? In other words, things don't even taste to me like they used to. I'm old. I'm not that much longer. Can I hear any longer the voice of singing men and singing women? Why should your servant be a further burden to my lord the king? Your servant will go a little way across Jordan with the king, and why should the king repay me for such a reward? Please let your servant turn back again, that I may die in my own city and be buried by the grave of my father and mother. But here is your servant Chimham. Let him cross over with my lord the king and do for him what seems good to you. Apparently, this Chimham was a son or relative of some sort of this Barzillai. And he says, look, I'm old, I'm going to die, but look after him. I would appreciate that. My point is here, God remembers, he makes provision, and he remembers kindness. He remembers the kindness that we show to other people. And just as David displayed this aspect of God's character, in fact, we can even carry forward to 1 Kings. Let's carry this forward to 1 Kings chapter 2. At David's death, David's death is imminent, and he's given instructions to Solomon. 1 Kings chapter 2, and he's giving instructions because he knows his days are very limited. He's telling Solomon there's a few things that you need to take care of. And one of them that David carries through on, he says, verse 7, but show kindness to the sons of Barzillai, and let them be among those who eat at your table, for so they came to me when I fled from Absalom, your brother. So decades later, David doesn't forget. He remembers the kindness God provides for his people. And in this aspect right here, we can see the heart of God displayed in the way that David handled this and remembered this Barzillai. Let's see if we can pick out a few more. Here's another one. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 38. Jeremiah 38, showing again God's willingness to help his people and the provision that God makes for people. Jeremiah chapter 38. Jeremiah, remember, was a prophet of God. He warned Judah. He was hated. Jeremiah chapter 38. Jeremiah was hated by the leaders, particularly the religious leaders. And at one point, they had Jeremiah lowered into a pit, basically a sewage pit of some sort, of mire. Well, there was this gentleman in the court here, Jeremiah chapter 38, and verse 7. Now, Ebed-Melech, Jeremiah is down in this dungeon. He's been lowered into this pit of mire. Now, Ebed-Melech, the Ethiopian, one of the eunuchs who was in the king's house, heard that they had put Jeremiah in the dungeon when the king was sitting in the gate of Benjamin. Ebed-Melech went out of the king's house, and he spoke to the king, saying, my lord the king, these men have done evil in all that they have done to Jeremiah the prophet, whom they have cast into the dungeon, and he is likely to die from hunger in the place where he is, for there is no more bread in the city. Then the king commanded Ebed-Melech, the Ethiopian, saying, take from here 30 men with you, and lift Jeremiah the prophet out of the dungeon. Verse 11, so Ebed-Melech took the men with him, and went to the house of the king under the treasury, and took from their old cloths and rags and let them down by ropes into the dungeon to Jeremiah. They put the cloths underneath his arms, and then Ebed-Melech lifted him up. They pulled Jeremiah up with the ropes and lifted him up. Jeremiah 39, we'll go to verse 15. So this Ebed-Melech had Jeremiah because of his involvement, because of his goodness, God used him to make provision for Jeremiah. Okay, now the word of the Lord, verse 15, had come to Jeremiah while he was shut up in the court of the prison, saying, "Go speak to Ebed-Melech, the Ethiopian, saying, Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, Behold, I will bring my words upon this city for adversity and not for good, and they shall be performed in that day before you. But I will deliver you in that day, says the Lord, and you shall not be given into the hand of the men whom you are afraid, for I will surely deliver you." God did not forget this member of the royal court, this Ebed-Melech. God used him to provide for Jeremiah, to provide for his safety, and now God did not forget. He provided for him. Said, the city's going to fall, but you are going to be okay. Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10 and verse 40. Matthew 10, 40. He who receives you, Christ speaking, he who receives you receives me. And he who receives me receives him who sent me. He who receives a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. And he who receives a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. And whoever gives one of these little ones only a cup of cold water in the name of a disciple, surely I say to you, he shall by no means lose his reward. The very simplest things that God says, you so much as provide a cold cup of water, and I am going to remember it. You give a cold cup of water to one of my people, and I am going to remember. God will make that provision. David, I didn't write it down, or I can't say for sure it was one of David's psalms, but one of the psalms says, I have been young and I have been old, and I've never seen the righteous famish. The promise of God. He will take care of his people. Whoever gives you only a cup of cold water. These verses show that the ultimate tie, that there is a tie between the treatment of Jesus and that of his followers, that there is a link. To give a cup of cold water to the least disciple, just because he is a disciple, will be rewarded. The cold water is not given because he is a prophet or because he is righteous. It is given because they are one of Jesus' little ones. When we live in such a manner as that, Jesus sees, when we live in that manner, we do those kindnesses to one another because God provides for us. When we live in such a manner, Jesus sees that in us. He sees the Father in us. When the Father sees us behave in such a manner, he sees Jesus in us. It's a family. It's a family. God is a God of kindness. God is a God of graciousness. And when we are people of kindness, people of graciousness, we are reflecting the very character of God. That's handing that cup of cold water to a disciple. You are displaying the character of God. God is well pleased with that. Remember, whoever gives one of these little ones only a cup of cold water shall by no means lose his reward. God is very aware of our lives. God has made provision, every provision needed for our lives, just as every provision was made for General Hooker. But he froze. He didn't do anything. He just froze up, lost confidence. And it's happened to God's people through the millennium. It happens to them as well. They get their eyes off of God, and they view the size of the opponent or whoever it might be rather than trusting God. General Hooker held every advantage. Every provision had been made, yet he froze. We want to make sure that that doesn't happen to us. Hebrews chapter 10, and we'll make this the final verse, Hebrews 10. We'll pick it up in verse 36. For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. You know, the promise, the reward comes later. God didn't promise us, you know, a rose garden, that we would spend our lives here on this earth, you know, fat and sassy, and that God is all concerned about our level of pleasure. God doesn't indicate that's really high on his radar screen. It is that we become like him. It is that he sees us hand, metaphorically, that cup of cold water to our brother or our sister. For you have need, verse 36, of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. For yet a little while, verse 37, and he who is coming will come, and he will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith. If anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. So to have those advantages that God has given us and not use them is to draw back. That is to draw back. And God says, I have no pleasure in that individual. But we are not, verse 39, he ends it very encouragingly, but we are not of those who draw back to perdition or to waste. That's what perdition, part of the definition of perdition is, just waste. Just like everything that General Hooker did was a big waste because he froze. He didn't do diddly squat with it. But we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul and take advantage of all of those advantages and the provision that God has given to each one of us.